Today's Teisho will be on case 43 in the Book of Serenity, Luo Shan's Arising and Vanishing. Introduction. One touch of the philosopher's stone turns iron into gold. One word of the ultimate principle transforms an ordinary person into a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then after all, you'll have no use for it. But tell me, what one touch is it? Case: Luo Shan asked Yanto, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yanto shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? Verse: severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair. A leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots. A dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. Bah! Arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? Today is day two of our sesshin, and once again I want to thank everybody for doing a wonderful job. It's really precious to practice together like this. I'm happy almost all the time, but I'm happiest at sesshin. I have a wonderful life, and I get up every day and I do my zazen. So even though there are challenges in every life, pretty much it's a wonderful world most of the time. But when I'm at sesshin, it's a wonderful world, and then some. It's just marvelous to be on this path, and it's marvelous to be on this path with each of you. It's just wonderful. We all are working together to make this possible, washing dishes, cleaning the floors, cleaning the teacups, replacing the napkins, cleaning the bathrooms, and sitting together. It's the most wonderful way to live. I really do. I just think this is a wonderful way to live. And there's something special about practicing together. I don't know what it is, but it's just remarkable. This kind of collective practice is just so precious. I was listening on NPR the other day, and Brian Lehrer had an interview with a singer and songwriter named Leonard Cohen. I don't know if you've never heard of Leonard Cohen, but for people of my generation, he was quite a famous songwriter. He wrote a song that was a big hit in the 60s, which is probably before many of you were born. But he wrote a song called Suzanne. And it was really famous. Suzanne will take you down, da 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 dee da dee da dee dee. Anyway, I can't really carry a tune, but it's a beautiful song. And you want to travel with her, and you want... Oh, there, stop. Pretty bad. But you may actually have heard it, and you may be able to guess from what I was trying to sing how it actually goes. Famous songwriter. And it turns out that later in his life, he went and entered a Zen center in California that's run by a very famous Rinzai teacher named Joshu Suzaki. And Joshu Suzaki is now something like 100 years old. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. He might be, he's either 100 or he's 101. Right? And he's still teaching. He's still doing sesshin, you know. I myself have never met a Joshu Suzaki, but Genki Roshi, my first teacher, knew him and actually sat with him for some time. Genki was 50 years younger. Well, I guess not quite 50 years younger, but he's probably 35 years younger, or I guess 25 years younger than, so 50, 35, 25, 25. He's 25 years younger than Suzaki Roshi. He sat with him for some time. When I was training with Genki Roshi, Genki would go down and sit with Suzaki Roshi. So I've never met him, but Leonard Cohen became his student. And the person who was interviewing him asked him, you know, she actually was wasn't Brian Lehrer, my mistake, it was Terry Gross. And she said, so what was it, you're going into a monastery, that must be pretty hard to take all that solitude. You know, all that solitude. He was there for 5 years. Right? And the interesting thing was that he said there isn't any solitude in a monastery or in a Zen center. He said, you know, you sleep next to people, you eat next to people. If people don't know about sesshin, they don't understand. But there's very little solitude, right? When you're in your room, somebody else is in the room with you probably most of the time. And when you're not in your room, you're on your cushion. If you come out here to get a cup of tea, you think, ah, finally I can be alone, right? There's three other people sitting there drinking a cup of tea. And if you say, I'll go for a walk, you know, I'll go out and hit the trail behind into the woods here. You hit the trail, who do you see? You know, here comes India, you know, here comes, you know, Gary, you know. So it's impossible, really, to get away from other people at a sesshin. And Leonard Cohen said that. He said, there's no chance of being alone when you're training, he said. And he said one of the interesting things that he observed was that, how did he put it? It frees you from the illusion that you can ever be alone. Something like that. He said it frees you from your craving for privacy. I think maybe that's how he put it. Frees you from your craving for privacy. He said that his teacher, Suzaki Roshi, called it polishing. That all the people at his Zen center, all the men and women at his Zen center, were sort of like a bag of rocks, right? And they're all in the bag together, and they're rubbing against each other, and they're getting polished. I don't think Terry Gross understood what Leonard Cohen was talking about. Because people do think about Zen practice as a kind of withdrawal from the world, becoming isolated, going into yourself, and so on and so on. But Leonard Cohen was trying to tell her that it's not like that, that the deeper you go on this path, the more you realize that things are inescapably interconnected. And that there is no possibility of privacy, right? The privacy is kind of an illusion. And in a Zen center, or in a sangha, or a temple, you begin to realize this is an impossible task. You know, when I first started practicing, was, I guess, like most people, you know, I didn't understand what sesshin was. And, you know, I think people start out practicing with the usual mindset, the usual everyday mindset. I mean, when I leave my house in the morning, I always want to look nice for my office. You know, I'm going to work, so I try to, you know, I have a clean shirt, and I get up, and I, after I sit, I might go for some exercise. I'll iron a shirt. And I make sure my shirt matches my pants and my shoes. And then I'll go out and into the world and think I look good. You know, make sure my hair is combed and everything, you know. And sometimes I'll go and look in the mirror to see if my glasses are straight, because I don't want to look like a goofy old professor with crooked glasses, so straighten my glasses. You know, this is like normal way we go through the day. And it has actually happened to me sometimes that I'll iron a shirt, I'll get on my pants, and I'll be going out the door, and my wife will say, "Wait a minute, those don't go." It's like, "What? Oh my God, you're right!" You know, so I'll go iron another shirt. You know, that was a close one. Thanks. My father used to have, my father was from the war generation. And when he was a young man, all the people who worked in jobs where you had to wear a suit had a white shirt, a tie, and a jacket. So there was no fashion conundrum, right? It was just like you had like 10 white shirts. You took a white shirt, you put on your tie, which was a black tie, you put on your jacket, which was a black jacket or navy blue, and you went to work, right? So in the 60s, all of this exploded on my father, and he was in a terrible quandary because his second wife wanted him to wear colored shirts, you know, like baby blue shirt, rose-colored shirt, and she bought him ties. And of course, he had no idea. So she actually had like a little thing on the wall, taped to the wall, that this tie goes with this shirt and this suit, right? So this is like normal human life. But when we come to Sesshin, something wonderful, I think wonderful, happens, right? Because you're sitting on the cushion day one, and you might still think, "Gee, I hope my hair is okay," right? Yeah? It's a human, right? And you think, "I hope I'm wearing," you know. But, you know, by now it's like, and by day three it'll be like, "Who cares?" Right? Who cares? And this is a great improvement, in my opinion. It's really wonderful to be free. It's like liberation, right? Liberation. I can remember going through this process early in the Sesshin, early in my Zen history, you know, of coming to Sesshin 2 with like, I wear this shirt, you know, and this shirt and these pants, and after like my first Sesshin, by the end I didn't even know if I had a shirt on, you know, it was just I would forget really whether I washed my face, I forget whether I brushed my teeth, you know, I was just beyond caring about those things. And I make a point of keeping myself clean at Sesshin, you know. But earlier in my practice, that was all just blown out the window. You know, it didn't matter. And all the niceties sort of go out the window. You know, everybody wants to be cool. Maybe I'm wrong, but most people want to be, you know, we want to be attractive, we want to be sophisticated, we want to be appealing. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not like sinful or something. It's a part of the game of being a human being, and it's a fun game. I mean, I was at Kmart a while back, looking actually for something for Sesshin. And I went through the men's clothes and I saw a cotton, 100% cotton shirt that looked great. And it was like, you know, $10 or something. And they had it in my size, so I bought it. And when I wore it to school, I felt like I was a little kid again going to school with a new shirt. It's great. So there's nothing wrong with that, you know. But when you come to Sesshin, it just blows all that out the window. And it's okay to like your new shirt, and it's okay, but it's also really wonderful to get rid of all of that. you know, just not to be concerned. And all the niceties are gone. There's no hope of being cool, right? It's a machine, you know. Because you're sitting there thinking, ring the bell. You know, nobody can see the tears, but, you know, cool guys don't cry, you know. You're begging for the bell to be rung, right? And you're sweating bullets. And it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, right? And that's really liberating, I think. Really, that kind of simplicity. It's like in the koan yesterday, there's a flavor to great simplicity, right? You know, yesterday for lunch, we had rice, brown rice, and we had broccoli, and we had cabbage. Today, brown rice, eggplant, green beans. Tomorrow, broccoli and possibly cabbage, right? You know? Day after, pumpkin, and that'll be great. Yeah. But you see, there's a kind of similarity to all of this, you know? I don't know about you, but after a couple days of sesshin, I find that brown rice is so good. It's so good. Isn't it? Maybe it's just me. But there's just something about it that's just so delicious. It's, I don't know what it is. It's just, I love this brown rice, you know? And boy, that broccoli was good, wasn't it, yesterday? I know it was, you know? And it's just broccoli. You know? Under other circumstances, you would, you know, people say, oh, no, I couldn't eat rice again. No. You know, but it's just heaven, and it's absolutely predictable. You know, something happens to us when we go to sesshin where we just give up on a certain kind of a project, right? It's sort of like being that kind of a self and living that kind of a life. And everything becomes much simpler. And maybe it's a little bit because we're desperate, right? I mean, we're just hanging on a lot of, you know, maybe I'm different, but, you know, I've been doing sesshin for 30 years, but I have to tell you, the first day of sesshin is, it's just slightly like being hit by a truck, yes? Because, I don't know about you, but when I go to bed at night on the first day of a sesshin, I'm tired, you know? And I noticed last night, I lay in bed until everybody was done in the bathroom, and then I wanted to go in and wash my face, and I sort of dozed off. And when I woke up, it was not very late. It was like 11 o'clock. I must have slept for 15 minutes. But this place, it was, you know, this was as quiet as you can imagine last night, the dormitory. Everybody was sound asleep. And boy, I had the greatest sleep. I mean, it was just like I closed my eyes, and I opened my eyes, and I felt so refreshed. And my muscles, even though I've been doing this, I don't want to discourage you, but even though I've been doing this for 30 years, you know, and I do this all the time, even when I'm not at sesshin, at the end of a day of sitting, my muscles are tired, you know. And last night when I went to bed, my leg muscles were really tired, and I got up this morning and they were, you know, the magic of our biology is that somehow they heal overnight. You know, it's like my legs just felt great. All of that, I guess all that lactic acid was gone. Somehow they pulled it out of the muscles and they felt fresh and clean. And it's just wonderful. It's just these simple things. This simplicity is so beautiful. So beautiful. Right? You know, the great Zen master, Shu Yun. Shu Yun was the greatest Zen master probably in the last 400 or 500 years. There was a very great Zen master in the Ming Dynasty whose name was Han Shan. It's not the same Han Shan as our lineage. That's the 7th century. This is 700 years later. 14, 15. Hanshan means not cold mountain, but silly mountain. He was a very great Zen master. But after him, probably the greatest Zen master was Shu Yun. And Xu Yun liked to tell a story about the Emperor of China, Puyi. And Puyi was, the last emperor. You might have seen the movie, The Last Emperor. He was a kind of person who got up every day, and his cooks would bring in, plate after plate after plate, and he'd peek under the top and look, sniff. Nope, not today. No, it'd be just like endless food. This is all part of the theater of power, right? I mean, basically, why do they cook so many dishes for the emperor when they know he can't eat them? Because they're making a political and cultural statement about the importance of the emperor, right? And the power of the imperial institution. Right? But he was the human who happened to be sitting in that chair, and he became a very spoiled person, right? So, if it weren't exactly right, he'd say, no, not today. Well, in a way, we've kind of democratized that, right? We've made that kind of pickiness accessible to ordinary people. What happened with Puyi was that at one point there was a sort of a revolution, and he had to flee during a period of political turmoil. He had to flee, and of course he couldn't flee as the emperor. He had to disguise himself as a simple person, and he was hidden in like farmhouses and things like this. At one point he was actually eating sweet potato greens. You can take a sweet potato if you're moving into a new apartment. You can take a sweet potato just from the grocery store, and you can put toothpicks in it and stick the bottom of the sweet potato in water, like in a jar, and it'll grow beautiful creepers, beautiful vines, and you can decorate your house with sweet potatoes. It's just beautiful. And you can eat them, better yet. In China, sweet potato greens were often used for like pig food, right? So at one point, all the emperor got to eat was the sweet potato greens, but they were so good, right? Why? Because he's desperate and he was hungry, right? And I just think that's such an important lesson. Right? This is the man who would sniff at the finest delicacies and say, oh, not today, a little too much vinegar. And eating pig food one day and just happy to eat pig food. One of my favorite books is War and Peace by Tolstoy. And in it, it's a story of a man who was at one time the richest man in Russia, Count Bezukhov. And he inherits, he's the illegitimate son of the richest man in Russia, and he inherits this huge amount of money. And he doesn't know what to do with it. He has so much money, he doesn't know what to do with it. And he tries this and that. He lives a lavish life. He goes to Paris. He becomes a dandy. And he's totally miserable. At one point, Napoleon invades Russia. And a whole system collapses. The whole civilization falls apart. And Puyi, Bezukhov has to sort of head out of town with a peasant friend of his, this peasant who's got nothing. He's got like a shirt on his back, literally. And he's hiding, and Bezukhov's hiding out with this peasant. And they just live out in the countryside day to day trying to get by while this army is laying waste to Russia. And for Bezukhov, it's such a discovery because this man is so happy. It's like a loaf of bread makes him ecstatically happy, right? The loaf of bread makes him ecstatically happy. Just being warm, is like a paradise for him. And that kind of simplicity is so wonderful, right? It's wonderful. And for the first time in his life, Bezukhov is happy. And actually, this actually happened to Tolstoy. Tolstoy was also a very wealthy man, and he was miserable. And he began to associate, he was interested in educational reform when he was young, and he wanted to help the peasants in Russia. And he began to actually do what many reformers never do, which is to live with the people they're trying to help. And, but when Tolstoy got to know the peasants, he suddenly realized that they were in some ways superior to him. In other words, they were not miserable, they were happy. And he was miserable. And he was trying to help them because he didn't know what else to do with himself. And he began to become very conflicted about trying to help the peasants make progress, because he began to think their way of life was superior to his. And people called him a dreamer and belittled him. Even and in fact, this is why he never won the Nobel Prize, because he probably a very great writer, one of the greatest in the 20th century, but his political thinking people didn't like. But I think he had an important point. You know, there's something about that simplicity which is majestic, right? It's just majestic. You know, when I was young, before I started doing Zen, after I finished my BA degree, I actually went out backpacking for like several years on and off. And I lived months in a tent with, all my worldly possessions were like my sleeping bag, my tent, my backpack, about 5 t-shirts, you know, some socks, 1 pair of boots, and I would get up in the morning and, you know, I had my little stove, my little compression gas stove, and I'd wash my face and make oatmeal, and I would sleep on the ground outside if it weren't too cold, and I had everything I wanted, and it wasn't really possible to live my life that way. I mean, I couldn't see myself doing that for the next 50 years, right? But I know that that simplicity was just wonderful. And when we come here to Sesshin, we go through this process of simplification, and it's so strange, because our whole culture is based upon a complication. Maybe culture in general is based upon complication, you know. We all have to have a different shirt. You know, it's actually a joke that if 2 people come to the party and they're both wearing the same clothes, it's an embarrassment, right? And you think, why would it be an embarrassment? But somehow we're all supposed to make a personal statement, right? And we do this with everything, you know. So, you know, if you look at, you know, house magazines, you know, your house is supposed to make a personal statement, and everybody's house is supposed to be different, and you want to collect items, and everybody does this. It's part of the adventure of life. So I'm not putting it down, but it complicates things so much that it's hard to get back to the source. You know, it's hard to get to the roots, because there's too many leaves, you know. And it please enjoy the adventure of life. You know, there's no sense wearing rags, you know. Wear a nice shirt, and that's important too. If you have to live somewhere, hang a nice picture on the wall. Enjoy the picture. But there's another dimension to life which is made possible by simplification. And that's what we're doing at this sesshin. You know, it's just like target goal is survival, right? Just, if I can just get through the next sit, I'll be happy. Wow. You know, I know so many people who are just miserable. I mean, really, the world, you don't have to look far to find unhappy people. I know people who have written multiple books. Like, they've written, you know, 5 or 6 books, and they're not happy because their books aren't famous enough, right? You know, they're not cited, they're not quoted by other scholars enough. So they actually are unhappy much of the time. They feel miserable. And you know, we often talk about a life well lived, a life well lived. But there's a certain sense in which, you know what? It's going to be a lot, you know, they're all lives well lived. See, there's a certain way, you know, please strive for excellence. You know, if it's martial arts, go for it. If it's science, go for it. I'm not saying don't pursue those things. But there's like two sides to life. You know, it's like two sides, there's two sides to life in a certain way. It's like yin and yang, right? Yin and yang. It's important to be a person. It's important to be pursue your adventure in life. You know, it might be painting, it might be science, it might be music. On the other hand, you know, there's this other dimension of life, which is you suddenly step back and realize this is all a game. You know, it's all a game. That just getting through the next 20 minutes on the cushion is heaven. You know, that we're adding to heaven all the time, and it stops being heaven. It's a strange thing, isn't it? We're constantly adding to heaven, and it stops being heaven. When you take everything away, there's a kind of simplicity where you begin to see the brightness of life and the purity at the heart of existence, you know? And it's that kind of simplicity we sort of lost, I'm afraid, in our culture. It used to be around more often. You know, I think at one time people just had fewer things, and maybe they were unhappy, but I think a lot of people knew that the secret of happiness isn't in acquisition of anything. It in a way, it's sort of just getting rid of and letting go. I remember reading in this magazine, New Mexico Magazine, about a part of Albuquerque which is near where my wife grew up. It's called Martinez Town. It used to be outside of Albuquerque. And most of the people who live there are Hispanic, Mexican. They don't call themselves Mexicans, but culturally a lot like Mexicans. And the journalist who wrote this story went to Martinez Town and interviewed all of these old people. These were people who were in their 90s at the time. And there was a fair number of very old people who were still around Martinez Town. And they had all grown up at the turn of the previous century. And it had been a difficult time, the 1910s, 1920s. And New Mexico was really a backwater then. It's still the second poorest state in the Union. But then it was just like primitive, actually. This reporter interviewed all these people, but it was just like person after person said, you know, we didn't have a dime, but we were so happy. We were just so happy. It was amazing. And I don't think they all got together before the interview and said, okay, now what do we say? We were miserable, but let's say we were happy. You know, I think they really were happy. And I'm sure they were very poor. There's just something about, what did they have? They didn't have anything. They had this moment, you know, and they had one another, right? They were sharing this beautiful moment. They had, I don't think they had privacy, you know. They had something else. It's really, really special. That kind of simplicity is so wonderful because you can begin to experience the intensity and the beauty of the moment. That's really, you know, what Zen is all about, is just being present in the moment in an open-hearted way without all of these, this clutter and these assumptions. It's very difficult. I mean, one way to think about Zen practice is that a lot of what we do is just trying to strip away the layers of culture, the layers of conditioning, And so that we can see things for what they really are, you know, without the cultural presuppositions. Apparently, culture is very powerful. I was just reading this study about how what you are told can affect the way you experience an event. There was some psychologists were doing a study of people were going to get something like an electric shock or something that was painful. And the people who were told in a few minutes you're going to get a rather painful electric shock experienced the electric shock differently from the people who weren't told. Somehow knowing that it was coming allowed them to prepare, and they rated the experience on some kind of a scale a different way than people who were surprised by the experience or who were told that what was coming was a pleasant experience, right? They must have been very upset at the end of the experiment, I guess. But language can really change the way we experience the world and can really distort the way we experience the world. That's a very simple experiment, but I think language forces us to complicate in ways that sometimes make it very difficult to see reality. And culture does the same thing. This culture puts so much emphasis on being special, being a self, having, you know, it's very difficult to just see the moment for what it is. So a lot of the first couple days of Zen practice are just like deconditioning, clearing away all the clutter, all the junk, so that we can just be present in the beautiful moment, and the brightness of this moment is just unspeakable, right? So wonderful. And so, you know, it takes a lot of work, but there's something about this moment which is going to be wonderful, and which is wonderful no matter what happens. See, that's the truth. How can this be? You know, we Zen people work on stripping everything away until we can experience this for ourselves. You know, the moment without any adornment, any interpretation, any labeling. There's something here, right? In fact, you know, even calling it the moment is a bit of a distortion. Right? You know, if you say, well, right now I'm aware of the sound of your voice, even that's a kind of, if you take away that, there's still something left. So even if I were to suddenly stop, there's still something left. And you could say, well, it's silence, which is a strange word, right? But even in the absence of the sound, there's something there. What is it? See? And you can think, and then you have consciousness, right? When you have consciousness, there's your consciousness. You look at your experience in a moment, you can see your consciousness. But you know, if you take away even the there's something behind the consciousness, which seems like the last layer, right? There's the experience of cold, there's the consciousness of cold. What more could there be? But there's something behind that that's even more fundamental. Something more fundamental even than that. And that's where we're headed. That's where we're going. You know, I don't want to mess it up too much by talking about it, by covering it up with words. Luo Shan asked Yan To, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? So, you know, people who start out Zen training have many forms of expectation, right? And they don't know what Zen is about. They think maybe they'll get magical powers. Maybe they'll be enlightened, whatever that means. And at some point, you just realize that it's all just flowing. You know, there's no chance of achieving anything. There's no chance of holding on to anything. You sit on the cushion and you see it for yourself. You know, the moment comes and the moment goes. And the moment comes and the moment goes. See, and this is real liberation, I think, real liberation. The moment comes and the moment goes. You know, everybody you know is going to die. It's not sad, it's just true. Everything you love is going to be gone. This is inevitable. This is the way of life, right? In my field, English literature, people are really addicted to holding on to the past, you know? So, you know, they really want to make sure nobody forgets all of these poets and all of these writers. And they work so hard to make sure that everything is remembered. But you know, the day is going to come when somebody says, William Shakespeare, and they say, who? Never heard of the guy. You know, it's going to happen. You know, it doesn't have to happen tomorrow, and I actually like Shakespeare, not as much as Tolstoy, but I like Shakespeare. But, you know, someday people are going to say, Tolstoy, who was he? And my unhappy friends who wished that they were famous literary critics, you know, those famous literary critics aren't even going to be remembered for 50 years from now. You know, I was once doing some research for a book, and I started reading the work of a man named Granville Hicks. Don't bother to remember his name. Granville Hicks. In the 1930s, Granville Hicks was the most famous literary critic in America. And everybody, he was so controversial. He was a Marxist critic in the United States in the 30s. And if you were reading Granville Hicks, you were in the know. And, he was at the top of his game and everybody envied him. And then, you know, actually he went to Russia, I believe, or at least he began to learn about Stalinism, and he decided to give up on Marxism. And he gave up on his political philosophy, and then he stopped writing literary criticism. And if you go into an English department today and say, do you know who Granville Hicks is? People say, who? But this is inevitably the case. You know, everything we become attached to is going to disappear. And that could be the occasion for sadness, except when you take it away, something is always left. Something more simple, something more alive is always left. You know, that's the amazing thing. You know, we have this expression, it's not the end of the world. I love that expression. Because many people think the end of the world really is coming. They're really convinced. You know, there's this series of books called the Left Behind books that are based upon the Book of Revelation. And they are a 12-volume set, and it's all about how the world is going to end. It's a fictional account of the Book of the Bible. And they've sold 60 million copies. So there's a lot of people out there who just read this as entertainment. But there's a lot of people who really believe this. The world's going to end. And I guess individually too, you know, we always think if this doesn't happen to me, it's going to be the end. And if I don't get that raise, it's the end. If I don't get, you know, into Yale, it's the end. You know, but you know what? It's never the end. That's the amazing thing. If you take it away and you take it away and you take it away, it's like it gets brighter. Brighter, brighter, brighter. That's the wonderful thing. What we think of as loss is always like a door into something bigger. Bigger, bigger, bigger. And so we simplify, and yet as we simplify, as we take things away, everything gets they're more powerful, right? So it's like rice is like thundering, right? Rice is like thunder. And man, that brown rice, I just love it. You know, it's got the power of, you know, I don't know what. It's just amazing. Just the taste of white, of brown rice, you know. Or dal. I mean, I don't know. Dal's just heaven. When you simplify, it's just, it's like winning the Nobel Prize. A bowl of rice is like winning the Nobel Prize sometimes, you know, if you're hungry enough, right? In fact, it probably tastes better than winning the Nobel Prize. So there's something about this path, yeah, that's really beautiful, really wonderful. And it's not going to, you know, don't think in terms of gain and loss, right and wrong. You know, you're not really here to answer your koan. You're here to experience your koan, right? We're not struggling past a test. We're at play in this beautiful universe. See, we're not. This is not like the GREs of Zen. See, it's not like that. And at the end, there's going to be this horrible penalty if you don't answer your koan. Humiliation. Or what? You know, I never answered my koan. Ever. You know, first of all, it's not going to happen. You answer your koan. But you know what? Even if you don't, there's something beautiful there. So don't worry about answering the koan. Just be with the koan. Simplify, simplify, simplify. And then this universe, it has no reason for existing. It has no reason. There's no purpose. It's infinite into the past and infinite into the future. Existence is bigger than human purposes. There's no meaning. There's no reason. And for 7 days in January, it's possible for us to stop being a Kurt or Bob or Bill, and it's possible to be the universe, to see things through the universe's eyes. No purpose, no goal, just pure play of present, the pure beauty, the beauty of pure presence, the play of pure presence. It's possible for us to put aside our, we don't have to worry about whether the shirt and the pants match. We can be the universe, what we really are. Yeah. So please, it's day two of Sesshin. I know how hard it is, and but just keep going. You know, just let, you know, the universe is unfolding through your breath. The universe is unfolding through your move. This is like the biggest life, and the road to biggest life is simplification, is taking away everything. So let it get taken away. You know, let it get taken away. Don't worry about answering. Don't worry about succeeding. Whatever you do, don't think, oh my God, I've been working on this koan for X number of months. Right? What a pity. You know, time is not real either. So, here we are on this precious occasion. I'm so glad you're all here. I'm so happy to be practicing with you. Let's just keep going. Let's enjoy this beautiful, beautiful life. This beautiful life. When arising and vanishing go on ceasingly, what then? Yanto shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? There's something deeper than coming and going. What is it? What is it? It's in this moment. Look, look. Verse. Severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair. A leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots. A dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. These are the different forms that existence takes, but there's something behind it all. Bah! Arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? What is it?